Welcome to the Art School Podcast. I'm Ken Goshen. Today, I had the distinct pleasure of speaking with one of my favorite living artists, Ilya Gefdel. Ilya is a painter, art educator, and the founder and director of the Visual Arts Center in Tel Aviv. Ilya has shown in 14 solo shows before he was 40. He's won numerous prestigious awards, and his work can be found in notable public collections in the US, Canada, Spain, and Israel. He has written for Haaretz newspaper and has done curatorial work for Rothschild Gallery in Tel Aviv. Ilya is an exceptional artist and thinker and a tremendous inspiration to me, so I'm very excited to bring his voice and his ideas to all of you. One important note, I highly recommend not stopping the episode when I say, I feel like we should end on this, and then ask Ilya to tell everyone where they can find him. This is because after he obliges, he asks to touch back and elaborate on a topic I brought up earlier. And trust me, you do not want to miss what he has to say. If you find this podcast valuable, please take a moment to rate it highly wherever you're listening, especially on Apple Podcasts, as they weigh listener reviews very heavily. Every five-star review helps this podcast reach more people, so thanks in advance. And as always, this podcast is brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. You can become a supporter too at patreon.com/Ken Goshen. By pledging just $2, you'll be invited to join me for a live painting demo every Thursday of January. That's roughly a quarter per demo hour. And you'll know your support goes towards helping me produce more educational content everyone can enjoy, including this podcast. Many thanks in advance. And now I bring you my conversation with Ilya Gefdel. So, Ilya Gefdel, thank you so much for taking the time for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a real honor to have you on because, as you may or may not know, you're one of my absolute favorite living artists. And I'm such an admirer of your work. And I think you're one of the people that whose work I show most frequently to my students, because I think there's so much to learn from the stuff that you do. And I think a good place to start is perhaps tell us where you studied and who taught you to perform this magic that you're up to.
Well, that's a lot of stuff. First, thank you so much. I didn't expect to hear this. I had no idea that my work is being shown to people on the other side of the Atlantic on a regular basis. Now, how did I get there? It's always a work in progress. So it's being somebody's favorite living or one of your favorite living artists, that's quite a load, and it's a pleasant one, but it's quite a load. And then I'm asking myself, well, how much more time do I have to live? And hopefully that's a lot of time. So it's part of what I do is about being a perpetual student. In terms of my formal education, I studied at the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore. I studied in Italy, mainly informally, but also in some short-term formal settings. And I studied quite a bit on my own, which I would say is the main aspect of any educational process for a painter. I can't say that I'm self-taught, but that wouldn't be true. I had some very, very important teachers that I still value and admire. But figuring stuff on my own has occupied at least, well, I don't know, well over 50% of my study.
Who are the teachers that you admire? Just if I could interrupt.
Well, it's there. Essentially, there are three types of teachers, as far as I'm concerned. There is nature that you look at. There is art history that you perpetually examine and re-examine, and there are people that you can meet in the flesh. Who have profound professional experience and who you can study from. In the Maryland Institute, I studied mainly with Mark Carnes, whom I had the great joy of meeting quite recently, years and years after I graduated. He's a very honest painter, very obsessive painter in the best sense. There are a few other people who I didn't study for an extended period of time in any kind of formal setting, but whose presence as human beings and as artists have been very influential, very inspiring. I would even say awesome, meaning like awe. Mm-hmm. They are awe-inspiring individuals and professionals. So unsurprisingly, one of them is Antonio Lopez Garcia,
mm-hmm.
Who I got to meet in Spain a few years ago. Another one is an Israeli painter, Jan Rauchberger. I didn't study with him formally, but we communicate and I get to see his work once in a while. And he's actually teaching at my school in Tel Aviv nowadays. And there are many others, but I'm just mentioning the main few that come to my mind as we speak. Before I went to the Maryland Institute, I studied drawing and composition with with a professional that most people wouldn't know, and never really exhibited. I didn't have much of an art career. And he was a glass sculptor by the name of Alexander Cochran. And he taught me, I was really young, and he taught me the principles of composition way before my formal training had started. These are the main few individuals in a nutshell. I mean, I don't want to offend anyone. There are many more, but I can't keep going on and on. At the same time, there are never too numerous. It's never enough, really. Because there are many people you respect. There are fewer people you admire, and there are always more people that you want to have a profound affinity with. If you have three, you're very lucky, and you have 10, you're just it's like winning the lottery, but it's still not enough.
That's interesting. I love how you put it, and the extent to which you emphasize the self-teaching and self-learning as part of what helps you develop your style. And I think this brings us to an interesting topic, because when one looks at your work, and all listeners should go look at Ilya Gefter's work before listening to this conversation, because it's going to inform a lot of it, at ilyagefter.com?
That's correct.
Okay. So your work, I think, is exceptionally, like, it's very unique in that it both looks completely contemporary, and there's no doubt that these are things that are being done in the 21st century, at least to me, but also it exhibits a strong affinity to tradition and to the great art of eons past. So maybe you could say a few words about your relationship to tradition, to contemporary art. What are you thinking about these things?
Okay. Well, that's there are quite a few things to unpack, and you can tell me when to stop, because I can
don't
keep going on and on.
Pressed for time. Go for it.
Okay. So there are. Art history is a vast thing, virtually infinite. I mean, it's bigger than any one of us. It's way bigger than any one of us. And it's kind of like history, like world history. You make out of it what you want. Because you cannot grasp everything, and you choose what to look at, and you choose how to make sense of what you see. What we as painters get from art history, I mean, it's very much affected by who we are and things we can't control, like my DNA, my unconscious preferences, where I grew up, and so forth and so on. And that's where I'm getting at. I was born in St. Petersburg. Yes, I don't remember if it was 5 or 6 when I went to the Hermitage Museum for the first time. I was taken to the Hermitage Museum. and it's a very, it's one of the greatest museums in the world. One of the largest museums in the world, maybe the largest, depends how you measure size. And it's quite traditional. So when I was six, it was still the Soviet Union. So there was no 20th century art to be seen past 1915, maybe. Okay. So you got to see a little bit of Cubism, and that was it. That was the end of art history. If you only got it from the Hermitage when at the time when I was there. It's a little okay. Now it has changed. And it has these amazing, amazing collections of traditional European art. One of the best collections of Rembrandt, other Dutch painters, Rubens, Velázquez. Not a huge collection of Impressionism, but very high quality.
And I'm assuming a lot of Russian artists, like probably Levitan and Repin.
Not in the Hermitage. That was in another museum.
I see.
So in the Russian Museum. So I got there only when I was 7. plus it's a traditional European palatial structure. So it informs your predispositions. You go there as a young kid. Then the main thing is that I loved it. I loved looking at paintings. I had very, very clear preferences. I knew what I liked and what I disliked. I couldn't explain it, but it was very, very clear to me from the early stage. Now, if I fast forward to my time in the United States, you know, I chose to study in the United States. It wasn't natural by any means. It wasn't easy getting there by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. And I was there to be one of the reasons why I wanted to be there is to be in the midst of this vast corpus of amazing collections. I was living in Baltimore, so I could travel to Philadelphia, Washington, New York, and so forth and so on, and I did. So by my second year in college, by my sophomore year, I told to myself that I must go to a museum every week. And I didn't limit myself to any particular museum. It could be anything. It could be the Walters Collection. It could be the Baltimore Museum of Art with some more recent artwork. It could be any place in Washington and so forth and so on. Because I wanted to. Why did I do that? I felt like I have to challenge my own knowledge and my own predispositions. So let's say if I grew up looking at Rubens and Rembrandt, I wanted to see some abstract expressionism. I wanted to learn what I wasn't getting from the formal college structure. And my feeling was that I was not getting more than I was effectively getting there, which I would say is natural in any art education. I wanted to fill in the blanks, as many blanks as possible. And I wanted to test everything that I was indeed getting from my professors. So let's say if Mark Carnes was saying anything, no matter how much I admired him, I wanted to see that in a museum. I wanted to go to a painter that I love from, let's say, I don't know, 19th century, early 20th century, doesn't matter. And I wanted, okay, and I would ask that painter, was my professor correct? Can I find a proof in amazing works of art in the museum to what I'm being taught or what I'm, or what I assume is right in painting?
That's extremely mature.
Yes. When you miss something, when something is absent from your life, you have to grow up. And I was feeling that a lot of knowledge was absent. And I was trying to find it. I was trying to extract it from. You don't need to find it. The museums are there. The great canon of art history is there. You open an art, the most basic art history book, and you discover what the canon is. And you can open another art history book and discover some alternatives. Okay, so the art is there to be seen. You have to extract the information out of it.
And I think that's so interesting, and it brings to mind another topic that I've been thinking about lately. I think the canon of art history and the way that we, you know, go there to kind of mine for knowledge and mine for information is still a little bit different than the corpus of many other disciplines, because some amount of that knowledge is still lost, I would say, unless you might disagree. But I think we do look at Rubens and we look at Rembrandt and we can theorize how we think they did what they did. And art historians theorize how we think they did what they did. But for many reasons, some of which were the fact that they needed a competitive edge and they weren't too inclined to completely write about exactly how they do what they do. There's something that is very different, I think, because we're doing a lot of guesswork. We're trying to build this puzzle in our head of how these things came about. And this requires us to be way more active. You know, you could passively learn a lot of disciplines when people just tell you what to do, but you're talking about a very active practice where somebody tells you something and then you go to the museum to verify and check it up against the data, against the evidence.
Well, I see what you're saying. There is no doubt that a tremendous amount of knowledge has been lost. I don't know what part of that knowledge is intuitive and what part of it is learned. And as far as I'm concerned, only a small part of the knowledge that I'm interested in is technical. A very, very small part of that, of the knowledge that I wish to discover, digest, and hopefully pass on in my paintings or in my teaching, only a small part of that is about how the paintings are to be made physically. If I put Rubens and Rembrandt aside for a second, and I go to, let's pretend that we go together to the Egyptian wing of the Metropolitan Museum.
There you might find lots of portraits of me by Fayum. I look like all
of
those
portraits. That's right. Well, but these are fairly recent. This is not exactly Egyptian art.
Right.
Okay. So if you go 1500 years into the previous era. Okay, it's like 1500 years BCE, 2000 years BC, and so forth and so on. Well, first of all, they don't look like you at all, these sculptures. So no worries. And in fact, they don't look like anything. We're looking at stone sculptures, some wooden sculptures too, but mainly things made out of very, very hard stones. I have no intention whatsoever of carving stone. I mean, I carved marble for a couple of weeks, and that has completely ruined my my fingers. Well, I recovered since then, but and marble is a very soft stone by comparison to the stones that the Egyptians preferred. So I have no intention of replicating that technically. On another hand, on a human level and on an aesthetic level, it's way out there. I mean, there's nothing like it. And it's very, very strange what you see there. It's very human, what you see there. And it's more contemporary than anything else. Because if you show an Egyptian sculpture to a person who has never seen an Egyptian sculpture, they will have no clue how to date it. Okay. It is more contemporary than most things you would see in the art that is being produced today. Because it's so strange, it's so unusual, it's so profound, and it's so human. And then I'm asking myself, okay, I have no intention of carving rocks, right? Then I ask myself, okay, what is so profound and what is so amazing about it? What is so human about those cultures and what is so beautiful about them? And if I can extract that information or that intuition, then I can carry it into my studio. But not on a technical level, because I'm using oil paint. Okay? So that is one extreme example of how art history can be fundamental, revolutionary. I mean, in a sense that an Egyptian sculpture can revolutionize my work, my attitude to art, without being a how-to thing.
Okay? So when you, if I may probe into what you said there for a second. So when you're asking yourself these questions that do seem extraordinarily profound, like what is it that makes this thing so extraordinary, so unusual, so difficult to date, and yet so human? What are some of the answers that you come up with?
Wow, that's a tough one, especially with Egyptian art. Anything I say would not be serious enough. Okay, because Egyptian art is so serious. Maybe to be a little bit more in a safer territory, I would, before I answer your second question, I will give a more open answer, more detailed answer to your previous question. What kind of questions do I ask works of art, and what kind of information I extract? Let's say, okay, where I leave the Egyptian section, the Egyptian wing of the Metropolitan Museum, and let's say we go look at some Rembrandts, and then a few paintings by Cezanne.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Personally, I have no intention to paint like Rembrandt. I would be very, very happy if I could do it. And if I knew how to, but I have no intention to do it for myself. It's like it's something that I want to know without doing it on a daily day or on a weekly basis in the studio. Well, same goes for Cezanne. I think. I mean, if you look at post Cezanne paintings in European art history, like early 20th century, they kind of look ridiculous. A lot of them, I mean, not all of them, but a lot of the painters who were influenced by Cezanne, I mean, that's just funny. Because they were influenced by a style which was indeed very, very charismatic as a style. It was revolutionary. It was something way out there, unexpected at that time. And of course, painters were kind of swayed by it. Some time has passed, and painting like Cezanne nowadays is even more ridiculous. It's more ridiculous than ever. And now it doesn't. So when we look at Cezanne, normally we don't do it in order to figure out, well, how did he mix those colors? What kind of brush he used, and what pigments he preferred, and what was his medium? We look at Cezanne to figure out something more structural, something more strategic, rather than technical. To figure out something more human. And for me, and when I mentioned Rembrandt in the same sentence, because I look at Rembrandt in the same way. Mm. I mean, I'm trying to find structural patterns. Mm. I want to find principles of aesthetics and principles of expression.
I think when you say structural to some of mm-hmm. us that are perhaps less familiar with your work and your teaching, they might mm-hmm. think, okay, the structure of the cheekbone, the structure of the nose, but that's not the structure you're talking about. So
no,
maybe God, elaborate
God,
on that.
No,
I know,
God,
I know, but maybe you should say a few words about that.
Well, by the way, I have nothing against learning the structure of the jaw bones or the facial muscles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to invest, if anyone wants to invest time in that kind of study, I mean, that's perfectly respectable. I believe that it's better to know than not to know. But sometimes when you know too much, you have to figure out what's important.
Right.
When I say structure, I mean the structure of the canvas itself.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of the rectangle, the structure of the big shapes of light and dark on the rectangle, the structure of the main shape, of the most essential shapes of color in the rectangle, and so forth and so on. Okay. So if you look structurally, you can look at a Cezanne and a Rembrandt in the same way. And the how to is, there's nothing alike. If you look at a painting from a how to standpoint, they're all very different, and it's kind of hard to tell which one's better. I don't think so. Like, let's say if you compare Rembrandt to Jan Leavens. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right. Well, they probably share the same studio. They painted in the same style, and you can look at their paintings and say, okay, this one was better. This one was a little bit less professional, and let's say you can compare Rembrandt to a Rembrandt or Rembrandt to a Rembrandt student, and you say, okay, this one's better, this one's worse, this one's not so great, because the parameters are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When the technical parameters are so fundamentally different, like let's say even if you compare a Monet to Cezanne, they were born in the same year. They lived in the same freaking country, but their languages were so different. You can't really compare the techniques. You can't say which one was better. Well, you can. Cezanne's technique was better for Cezanne, and Monet's technique was better for Monet. Now, which technique is better for Ilya Gefter, or for you, or for anybody? Who knows? And the way to figure that out is to look beyond technique, to ask myself, what the hell do I want to say in a painting?
Mm-hmm.
What interests me on a more human level in a painting? Okay. When I know where I'm going, where I want to get, I kind of know how to walk. I figure out a way how to walk. What kind of unique limb will I have if I know the direction?
Interesting. And when you say trying to figure out what you want to say with a painting, it mm-hmm. strikes me that you're not necessarily talking about the narrative that is on the surface. Like, for example, if we're looking at an Egyptian sculpture, you're not thinking, oh, I want to say that there's a man with a hawk's head, right? You're talking about what's underneath the representation. Maybe you can say.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. Well, we live in an era of conceptual art, and so things get a little bit confusing when we talk about, when I speak of content, I don't speak of concepts. These are completely different things, and I'm as a painter, I'm interested in content. So, and if I want to say something in a painting, it must be something that can only be said in a painting and cannot be said in an essay about a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think of painting as a means of communication, I'm actually being anti-conceptual.
Mm.
Now, there are many things that can be said in a painting through the language of painting. And only through the language of painting. But there are many directions that you can go into.
Maybe at this point, just to make sure that I'm bringing our listeners in, I think I'm totally on your wavelength, and I'm completely following along and relate. I just want to make sure that our listeners understand what it is that we're talking about. And I think maybe a good way to start into delving into this topic is talk a little bit about the relationship between representation and abstraction, or representation and materiality. Because, for example, let's see, you have a recent body of work, you're painting a lot of seascapes. Mm-hmm. And if I was just a casual bystander, not familiar with what you're up to, I would say, oh, Ilya is painting the sea. These paintings are about the sea, right? But I see your smile indicates that there is probably something deeper than that. So maybe you could use the representation versus abstraction / materiality framework to explain what you're thinking about these topics.
Okay, sure. I'll try to do it step by step. As far as I'm concerned, a good painting is not about the things that are written about that painting. Okay? So whatever can be written about, let's say, Mark Rothko,
mm-hmm.
the actual painting is not that. Okay? It's a completely different experience. Sitting in front of a Mark Rothko is not the same as reading about that painting. Or looking at the reproduction of that thing. And so I'm not saying that there is no concept there whatsoever. Maybe there is, but the actual thing is not the idea that was invested in it. It's not the idea that was extracted from it by an art critic. It's something else. Okay. Now, when we look at a representational painting, as far as I'm concerned, a painting is not about what it represents, if it's any good. Okay? It can also be about what it represents. So let's say when we go back to a Rembrandt, his late portraits are to a certain extent about that person who was sitting next to him, right? Most likely that is the case. If the nature and the likeness of Rembrandt's sitter was the only subject matter in that painting, we wouldn't be looking at it, okay? Those paintings are also about us. You, me, anyone who is listening, they're about you guys, okay? Because you find yourself in them,
mm-hmm.
okay? They're human. They're not about some fur merchant. They could also be about him, but they're also about something else, okay? some paintings can only be about something else. And let's say if we, if we go back to Cézanne's still lifes aren't about apples. If you want to learn anything about apples, please don't look at a Cézanne. Please don't. okay. They're about something else. About maybe, as far as, again, my personal interpretation of, let's say, Cézanne still life, well, they're about presence. They're about three-dimensional presence. They're about a very, very fine line between structural order and disintegration. The still life itself was just a vehicle to get somewhere. Is it a representational painting? Yes, it is. Cézanne is representational still, and most other painters are representational in one way or another. But if the painting is any good, it's not about what it represents. And maybe that is one of the simplest and most fundamental differences between painting and illustration. Mm. Let's say an illustration of an apple is about that apple. It can also be quite beautiful, but it's kind of secondary. It's, you know, you illustrate what it is, and that's the main task. While in painting, it's your least important task to show how the apple looks. Now, does it mean that very, very true to life paintings of apples aren't any good? No, not necessarily. Not necessarily, as long as they express something beyond the thing itself. Mm. For example, the light on that thing, which is something I learned a lot. I learned from Mark Carnes, by the way.
In what sense, the light? Like the light hitting?
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. The magical potential of expressing light,
Which of course also ties back to Rembrandt in some way.
Of course, yeah, of course.
I think there's something extremely profound about this way of thinking, and it's of course something that I also try to follow very strictly. This idea that the way that I usually talk about it is there are multiple layers, and I don't know if you agree, but it's going to be interesting to discover. I think there are multiple layers to a painting structurally, in the way that you've used the word structure. And part of the interesting tension within those layers is, for example, how the narrative, what is depicted, is conflicted or brought to bear against the way something is painted, right? We can paint an apple, and we can paint an apple like a storm, bold brushworks, extremely thick paint, or we can paint an apple like Serenity with tiny little brushes with a completely smooth surface. And it could be the completely same apple, but these two paintings are going to feel totally different to an observer. And for me, it almost is, it's similar to, for example, the relationship between lyrics and music, right? Lyrics is what is the song saying, but the harmony, the music, the chords, what's underlying it, can either be in concert with the words, or it could be in conflict with the words and create an interesting tension. Like you could have happy words with sad music, or you can have happy words with happy music. And one of them is going to be more likely to be kitsch. One of them is more likely to be a masterpiece because of the interesting tension between the materiality or the tools that we use in order to construct this piece of art, and then what lies there on the surface, like words or what is painted, how that relates to the more structural elements.
You're talking about the form content thing, how the different layers of structure relate to the content.
Well, in that case, content is going to be more inclusive than what I mean. Content is a pretty inclusive word, but what I mean is literally like the representation. Oh, that's an ocean, right? Because content can also be sublime. You know, the content can also be what is being painted. There is content in Rothko.
So what was the question again?
I'm sorry. I think I was just agreeing with you. So another thing that I really want to touch on that I think is really interesting is the fact that your approach to art, which is at the same time very loyal to the practice of observation and extracting data, harmony, and everything that there is to take from the world that is around us, while still putting the emphasis somewhere else. The emphasis, at least the way that I gather it is from looking at your students' work, which are incredible, is there's a lot of emphasis on design. I see in their work, you really manage to communicate this objective of, we're not just doing the apple, we're trying to make a painting. You know, don't be concerned with just painting this glass of water representationally, but rather make a painting that includes the glass of water. But first and foremost, it's this painting. Now, this is it's a pretty unusual thing, because usually when I look at the work of beginners, they're completely hijacked by this desire to represent something and to make something that looks like a thing. But in your school, which maybe you can also tell us a little bit about, it looks like that thing is not even entering the classroom, because you do post some of your students' work, and I'm always shocked by how, whether or not they're successful about the representation, these people are trying to make paintings, and I think that's a big deal. So maybe you can say a few words about that, and maybe give us some tips to those of us listening who are students of the craft. How can they be more focused on making paintings as opposed to strictly focusing on the representational qualities of the piece?
Wow, that's a lot.
Sorry, I just dropped a bomb.
No. Sure. I'll try to respond to a few things that you are saying, and if I miss something, so feel free to point out what I'm missing, and I'll try to get to everything. Before I get to teaching about art, some feedback to your earlier comments. Well, there is the, in a representational painting, there is the thing that you paint. Okay, lately it has been the sea in my case, or it could be a rose in someone else's case, or a portrait. Okay, so there's what it is that you are representing. then there is the material that you are using, the language, or language is a better word, which essentially includes both the materials and how it is being used. So we can use oil painting in completely different ways, as you expressed. And then there is something really elusive, which is, you know, what I said, what it is that I want to say, or no, not even what I want to say, not what the painter wants to say, what the painting communicates to the educated viewer. We can, for lack of a better word, we can call it content. Okay. These are three different things, and I was saying that I'm totally agreeing with you that that the thing that we paint is not the material that we use, and we can paint the same apple in completely different languages using the same colors. Okay, so. And those differences, how different painters would paint the same apple using the same colors, but having different intonations and having different phrasings in their sentence structure, like I use that word metaphorically, of course, how they apply paint, what kind of color relationships they create, what kind of textures they create. All these things are structural on one hand, and on another hand, these are the things that directly inform the content. Now, for the painting to have any pictorial content, it has to be a painting. So, and that's where we get to the idea that what it is that you paint or anyone paints is secondary. And in order to make a good painting, let's say to make a good still life, if you look at a bunch of oranges in front of you, you must not paint the oranges. you have to take them apart as sources of raw pictorial material, colors, lines, shapes, and you have to select which of these raw materials are useful in your painting, and you have to put it back together again. Now, in order, now you asked me a very interesting question: how can I explain to listeners or to my students that a painting is a painting, and how to make a painting that looks like a painting rather than being an illustration of an orange or a glass of wine or water or whatever?
Exactly.
Well, in my school, there are really no shortcuts. It takes time. It takes time for me to distill the ideas into very, very clear sentences. And it takes time for my students to absorb these sentences that I'm saying and have them inform the structure of their studies. So the element of time is really essential in this craft. It's not how to think that you can learn and then do automatically. Information is very important, but it's not enough. Yeah, it has to be experienced, and it has to be digested through work.
But maybe there are still a few things that, for example, you see in some people's work, and then you have to advise them, listen, this is not exactly where you want to be focused. I'm just going to give a simple example, because I know that people who are listening to us are just going to be, really want to get at some of those things. Incorporate them.
I'm just being slow.
All right, then I won't give my example. Then I can't wait to hear yours.
Oh no, please do. Give your example.
So I was gonna say that for me, for example, I would see a student. You were saying that there's a bunch of oranges, right? And these students are extremely busy with trying to make those bunch of oranges look like a bunch of oranges. And then I might come around and say, well, perhaps you should be more concerned with where that bunch of oranges falls in your frame. Right now, a lot of my attention is being given to the bottom most right corner of the frame, because you've been there for 2 hours trying to paint an orange, and there's nothing on the top left side that's going to balance me against those oranges. And that's going to lead to me looking at your piece of oranges and not wanting to linger there for one extra second, because the frame is not designed. And that means you are illustrating oranges to me in a way that does not add up to becoming a painting. A painting should be something that stops me in my tracks. You know, I'm walking through a museum, there's a million things around me. There needs to be something about the design of that frame that causes me to stop what I'm doing, devote some time to this visual object that's in front of me, and then I can walk up close and be impressed with how you rendered an orange. But that doesn't happen first. That happens later. So this is like people worrying about putting sprinkles on the ice cream, but there's no ice cream in the cup yet. So the sprinkles are just piling up on the bottom of the cup. And that's how silly that looks like to me.
Yes, yes. Well, we pretty much give the same examples in very, very similar words. I pretty much say the same thing. Except that, well, I teach in Israel, so we're being far less politically correct. And I don't give the ice cream example. I give a different example. I give a different example. I say, well, okay, let's say that you've been rolling in mud for the last 2 days, or you've been living amongst the trash cans for the last 3 weeks. And now you want to make yourself pretty, okay? Are you starting with makeup?
I love that.
No, okay. Maybe you first take a shower, maybe go to the gym, or get a haircut, and makeup is the last thing. And then there is a question: well, when are we ready for it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is very simple: as soon as it becomes unnecessary.
Mm. Oh, that's great.
As soon as the rendering of the orange becomes completely unnecessary for the quality of the painting, that is the time when you are ready for it.
Wow, I love that. And what made you decide to open your own school? What led to that?
Okay. Interesting. Well, I'll try to answer that. Before I opened my school, I was teaching for some time in other private institutions, and I figured out that just like, let's say, when you study in a certain place, okay, when you're a student, the peers you are around affect your work. And I was surprised to discover that the spirit of the school where I work also affects my work, although I'm no longer a student formally. And sometimes you want to get out of a certain, let's call it spiritual structure. I don't mean spiritual in a religious way. There is a spirit to a place, like something very local, okay? And you want to go somewhere else. So where do you want to go? You don't know in advance. You have to create something new. Now there are also way more pragmatic things involved. Like when I was hired as a teacher, well, I was observing how the schools operate, and I thought, well, I would do it differently. I thought that they can be done better. There are certain projects that I would like to do which aren't being done. At a certain point, I felt, okay, these projects that I envision, they are not going to happen here. for all sorts of reasons, and doesn't even matter what the reasons are. If I want to develop as a teacher, which I don't have to, but if I want to, well, maybe that's a time to start something on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I mean, I was taking it. I was doing it gradually. My school. I started with some very, very small classes independently. And the following year, I had a studio space for the school, and now we are, if I'm not mistaken, we're completing We're in the midst of our fifth or sixth year.
Wow. That's amazing. And what's been the experience of having your own school? And was it everything you wanted it to be? Were you able to implement all these projects that you thought were not happening when you were working in other places?
Well, fortunately, it's not everything that I wanted it to be, because if that was the case, it would mean I wanted very little to begin with. I'm not saying that to denigrate what has been done at the school. I'm just saying that I aim a lot higher. There are some projects that I envisioned and they did take place, which is very gratifying. Mainly, having a school isn't about art, really. I mean, that's the sad truth of it. It's not about art. It's about administration. It's about renting a studio space. About keeping it relatively clean and so forth and so on. I'm not starting to complain about it. I want to be very, very honest. Mm-hmm. As I respond to your question, the creative idea involved in having a school is that you have to learn lots of new things. I was trained as a painter. I studied art history. I studied a little bit of sculpture. Having an art school is not about that, right? So it put me in a position of having to go to school all over again and study new things.
Mm.
Okay, I didn't have the privilege of 2 years of business administration studies or MBA or whatever it's called before I do anything in real life. Okay, so I had to and I still have to learn things as I go, and as I learn things, I implement them and try to be creative with all kinds of technical and administrative and strategic solutions. It's not all boring stuff, because essentially in an art school you create an environment.
Mm.
I was talking about the spirit of places where I taught as a hired faculty. Okay, well, you create a spirit of a new place. And you want that spirit to be positive for the vast majority of people who come there. You want it to be uplifting, and you want it to be professional. And that part of having an art school is really, really creative.
Mm. That's brilliant. I think I'm totally with you, because when I think back to the various institutions where I studied, the degree to which I felt like I was learning and I was succeeding had so much to do with the atmosphere, with the community, with the other students that are around me, with a feeling of a shared goal, and successfully creating that environment, I think is the main goal of having a school. At least that's how I think about it, and at least from looking at the works that your students produced, it's looking like that atmosphere is definitely happening.
Well, I very much hope so. I cannot be clearly aware of it because I'm always at the in the process. When you keep chopping wood all the time, you have no idea how the ship looks.
Right.
The only way to figure that out is really communicate with students and see what they are doing, and I'm trying to do just that, to look at my students' work again and again, figure out what have I constructed through the smallest and simplest still lifes or portraits that they make.
And I'm sure Corona must have introduced a lot of obstacles into the mix, both I'm assuming in the studio and in the school. How did you manage that? How did you negotiate that? Did that cause any changes that have to be implemented in order to come to terms with the new reality?
Well, you asked that question in a very, very unreasonably optimistic way. You phrased it in past tense.
Oh, that's true. Pardon my optimism.
You see, I'm in we were speaking whether which painting is realist and which one isn't. In that sense, I'm squarely a realist painter. No place for excessive optimism. I'm a realist. okay, so
feel free to go as dark as necessary.
We're in the midst of it. Hopefully towards the end, as we speak, we're right now we're in the beginning of our third lockdown. So my classes once again shift to online format. There are all kinds of solutions that I've implemented when the corona crisis has started. I can't say that I'm having fun doing that, not at all. But it requires even more creativity, looking for creative solutions. I have adapted to the Zoom format, and that has completely restructured my classes. I mean, it would be completely ridiculous to teach the way I normally teach, except doing that through the digital media. I've restructured my classes. I have created new types of educational products. So let's say I've designed workshops that are adapted to the online format. I've recorded three workshops that do not require my presence. They can be purchased on the school website and downloaded. Who could have thought that anyone in the right in the right mind would be doing that kind of stuff? I mean, you study painting in the dirty studio, and the corona crisis has changed that. And here my pessimism kind of ends. Because I think there are some, it has brought some positive changes and some really, really, it has necessitated some really interesting solutions that are not just business models that deal with unpleasant situations. We really managed to create new ways of teaching that are effective, that are useful, that are time and space friendly.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. Both sides of that statement. The first, which is who would have thought? I mean, if you asked me a year ago, I would have been like, what are you talking about? Let's go to the Met, you know, let's be there in person. Let's be all together. But now I've grown so impressed with what the wizards of tech have provided us with in terms of these tools and how we can adapt them for teaching online that it just really I'm blown away not by how possible it is to teach, because this really depends on us as teachers and isn't as interesting as looking at the results that the students are showing. You know, the actual metric that I am very conscious of is whether or not after I've communicated something online to somebody who's in Australia and we've never met and likely won't meet anytime soon, whether or not they understand it, can implement it, and demonstrate that this knowledge has you know, passed on. And I think it's at least on my end, it's undoubtedly working. You know, people understand, they don't need to be in the same room with me as I thought they needed to be. And also I've noticed that beyond having to develop new ways of structuring the curriculum, I had to become better as a teacher because I can no longer just grab their brush and show them on their canvas. You know, I was so used to thinking like, this is the wrong color, but let's mix it together. Applied, and it works. But now I have to literally communicate, okay, so you need to put much less yellow, much less white in order to negotiate that value. I need to actually learn to say everything. Because now it's all about our ability to communicate. So I feel like it has necessitated a much more rigorous way of communicating the knowledge, at least on my part. And when this crisis ends, and it can't happen too soon, I think those of us who've been committed to making this change work will come out of it with some tools, new tools in our box.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like I've experienced everything that you're saying. I'm profoundly encouraged by the paintings that my students managed to produce, even though I don't see them in person, neither the students nor the paintings. Well, eventually I do see the paintings because even we do meet for critiques in the studio. Even if it's only once a year, we make that happen. Mm. So I do see the paintings eventually. And it's always pleasant to discover that the photographs are not that far from the truth. That the photographs are representing the qualities that actually exist in the real thing. Mm. We do have to communicate way more clearly. And we can't use our hands too much when we're in front of the screen. And that's definitely a positive thing, because this is how we clarify our thoughts about painting for ourselves. The thing that I do miss tremendously, and which I find irreplaceable, is a physical contact with art.
Mm.
I can communicate a lot to my students without seeing them in person, but I cannot get enough communication channeled into my senses without having that Rembrandt in front of me.
Right.
For all these months, my suffering from digital images has only been increasing. I want to see the real thing. Great art has to be experienced in front of great art, and we need to be in its presence.
I totally relate. I just want to jump in and ask whether or not you think that's a definitional thing. Like when you ask yourself, what is a painting? What is a great painting? Is it by definition something that has to be experienced when you're there in person? I mean, I would say yes, but I'm wondering how you think about that.
Well, I think that to me it's one of the definitions of a great painting. A great painting is that which cannot be channeled through any means of reproduction.
Hmm.
Photographs, whether prints or digital photographs, are usually making bad paintings better, and they usually make good paintings worse.
Hmm.
and they leave very, very little out of the totality that there is in a great painting. When I go to a museum, I usually, like all of us, I take my sketchbook. More often than not, I don't even bother sketching. I just write. I write pages and pages and pages of observations. Observations that I experience in front of that work of art. In my last visit to a great museum that was in Naples, two great museums, Capo di Monte and the National Archaeological Museum. So I feel like there are loads of information that I'm absorbing and I just have to write it down while I'm there. I can look for hours at the digital image on my computer screen, and I don't know. It's like, it's nice. It's better than nothing, but it's way better than nothing. But the scope of information that I get out of it is very minimal. And maybe it's because in painting, when in the art of painting, information isn't just information. It's experience. It's emotion. It's like as if you were getting information in an envelope of human experiences that cannot even be quantified.
That's beautiful. Okay. I think this also ties back, and I'm growing increasingly conscious of your time. So I think we're gonna.
No, I'm fine.
You're fine. Okay, so this ties us back to something that I told myself that I wanted to go back to. So we were talking about the Egyptian sculptures, and we were saying how they're very difficult to date. They're very difficult to kind of even wrap our heads around. And you're saying that it's this quality of art that you're looking for. You're looking for capturing that kind of essence in your own practice. And you're saying that you're in the museum and you're taking all those pieces of notes that all of us want to see published one day. But perhaps give us a clue into what are those things that the great art of the past, that kind of art that cannot be dated, what's being distilled in your mind when you're contemplating this thing? What makes them great? What makes them timeless?
Ooh, okay, that's a lot of question in a few phrases.
Sorry.
What makes them timeless? They look back at me and I see myself in them. That's what makes them timeless. I mean, it's not even about art. It's beyond art. We had in the Tel Aviv right now, we have an exhibition of Jeff Koons, which I got to see. So this stuff is dated. It's no longer interesting. You've seen it yesterday. You don't want to see it tomorrow. It's really dated. And why is that? Well, it's you can analyze it on all kinds of levels. You can dislike the colors. You can think that the style is kitsch. Well, it's that too. But it's just there is not a single cell of me in them. They are not revealing anything about myself. Okay. The critics, like the more positively disposed critics of let's say an artist like Jeff Koons, they're saying, well, they tell a lot of things about our time and the consumer culture and blah 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 blah. Okay, fair enough. they tell me about our time and our consumer culture. Fair enough. Do I see myself in that work of art? And I'm afraid in a way you can be really, really dated communicating about really contemporaneous experiences in your art.
Mm.
Because you say something about today, it may still be relevant tomorrow, it may be not, but if there is no human germ in it, then there is nothing, there is no texture to rub your eyes against.
Mm. But what causes that human germ to exist or
okay,
not exist?
Yeah, so that's the other part of your question. I'm still answering the first word.
No, sorry. I'm so overwhelmed with how good how much I have to ask. So it's kind of coming out in bursts.
So what now? The problem with painting is that you can't say, "Well, I feel so human today." I'm all love and kindness today, and I will channel that energetically onto my canvas, and I will exhibit that, and people will have that profound spiritual human experience. Well, that's bullshit. Okay? Paintings are made with mud. They're made with dirty brushes. They're made with all sorts of strange materials that you don't want to put in your mouth. They're not made with thoughts and emotions. Okay? You can experience whatever thoughts and emotions as you paint, but if you have no clue how to use those materials, well, I'm sorry, you may be a wonderful human being, but you have to learn a lot about the craft. So what are the prerequisites what are the formal visual prerequisites for a good work of art to be relevant today, tomorrow, or no matter when it was created, yesterday or three centuries ago? No one can give a full answer to that question, because that's what we perpetually try to figure out. This is what I was trying to figure out as a student going to museums. This is what I keep trying to figure out again and again and again and again, because the answer is never complete. On the most superficial level, and by superficial, I mean visible, which is not a bad thing. I mean, superficial in painting is also very, very fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's the form. It's the structure. It's the visual structure. How that thing in front of us is constructed. How do the parts make up the whole? How do the parts create internal tensions amongst themselves while being one thing?
Mm.
Egyptian art is the better specimen of Egyptian art are great teachers.
Mm.
These are sculptures mainly. Well, okay, there are these amazing Fayum portraits, which are exactly Egyptian, but they are as great as any painting that was ever made. The better ones, at least. It's about how it is structured and how the parts have tension amongst themselves while being one unified thing.
I love that. I think I'm going to add maybe my two cents on it, because of course it's something that I'm also thinking about and hoping to one day be able to create. I think there's something that's extraordinarily compelling, hypnotic, and attractive about an object that exhibits the feeling that the whole is more than the sum of the parts. I think something totally fails if it has more, you know, tiny little detail and pitch of guess that later does not translate to a large, simple kind of message, a striking presence. And I think there is something about, you know, looking at the Egyptian work or at Rembrandt's work, where you see it, in the Egyptian work, it's even more clear. You see, these are very, very simple shapes, very geometrically designed, harmoniously put together. And what comes out of it is this, whatever it is, a deity or an animal or something that feels like it could not have been made from such a collection of simple shapes, right? Or when you get that feeling when you look at a Rembrandt and initially, you know, you're stricken by how it looks like he has a glossy metallic armor, but you come up close and there's no metallic, no armor, no nothing. It's just a calligraphy of very simple marks. And those very, very simple marks that are not at all, they don't appear labored, they don't appear contrived. They appear just an honest, concise sentence, a few very simple statements that then transfigure into something that's much bigger. And I don't know if you relate to that, but to me, this is really something that I find in common with art that I call timeless, that something great has been created from the parts that are visible on the surface. And I see that they are simple. I see that all the parts are simple, but the magic happens between how simple the parts are and how magnificent and majestic the whole is, which also should serve as some kind of motivation to those of us listening to not worry too much about the detail. Actually, don't worry about how many details you can put into a painting, but rather maybe how many details you can get away with not painting at all while still prioritizing this feeling of the entire picture, the whole image.
Well, you're absolutely right. There are parts and there is a whole, and we don't quite know how the whole becomes so much greater than the sum of its parts in great works of art. But I have a hypothesis how we can strive there. How we can strive to make those great paintings that are way more than the sum of their parts. And my hypothesis is very simple. Get rid of all the unnecessary parts.
Beautiful.
When every single part of a painting becomes necessary, the painting has a pretty good chance of being better than all the parts on their own.
I love it. That's so profound. I feel like we should end on this. So, Ilya, maybe you can tell our listeners where they can find you.
My physical body is currently in Tel Aviv.
And for those of us interested in your work and your teachings,
I'm joking. My personal website, Ilya Gefter, ilyagefter.com. That's where you can see my recent and not so recent paintings. Website of my art school is visualartcenterta.com. You can spell Visual Arts Center and then put TA at the end, .com. I'm on Facebook. I'm a very lazy Instagram user, but I have an Instagram account. I think it's Ilya Gefter .art. But well, if you look up Ilya Gefter, you'll find me. Media where you can find me. Oh, and I also have a YouTube channel, which isn't that active, but occasionally I do post hopefully interesting videos, some lectures that I've delivered, some fragments from my art classes. So you are more than welcome to follow that too. I think if you type Ilya Gefter on YouTube, you'll find it. And I feel kind of bad that there was one question you asked twice and I didn't give a full answer.
So
and
we must include it then.
If I may, that was a practical thing. And so if I can hopefully leave a little bit of practical advice, I'll be happy to do that.
Go for it.
So you were asking me at a certain point how do I express to my students that a painting is a painting, and how come they hopefully manage to manifest that idea in their work? Mm. Well, there are two ways in which I do it. First, I discuss what a painting is, and the answer to that question isn't that simple. I discuss what a painting is as an object, like is a piece of paper or canvas stretched on a rectangular wooden frame, and what's in it, what makes that canvas into a painting. Well, it's shapes of color, maybe some lines, tones, different values, and so forth and so on. So we discuss what a painting is as an object structurally, what it's made of. Okay, it's a rectangle with certain things in it, and we discuss what these things are. Now, I also discuss painting as a completely different terms. Painting is a process. A painting is not just a thing. In the English language, painting is a verb and a noun. Mm. And if you separate the verb from the noun, you are left with a piece of the most boring decoration. Okay, so what is, let's say, what is the difference between a copy of a Monet and a Monet? There are many ways to look into it. But of course, we all want the real thing because it's more expensive and you can sell it on Sotheby's and so forth and so on. But let's say, okay, we don't get to sell it. Like you have to keep it. You're not allowed to make any money. You're not allowed to earn a single dollar. You get to keep it. So why is the Monet better? Well, it's better. It has more, it's more profound. It has more presence. Why? Because a copyist is copying the surface. He's taking the process of arriving at that surface out.
Mm.
Okay. So a painting is more than the object. It's the physical process that was invested into making it. Okay. So, and I really emphasize the physicality. And we'll get to that in a second. So in order for paintings to look like paintings rather than illustrations, I first discuss what a painting is. Then I do something real, someone kind of maybe evil. I impose strict limitations. So I give a list of things to what you must not do. And these limitations force the students to put aside their natural tendencies and expectations. So let's say a certain student really likes to paint textures in a certain way. I impose the limitations that make it impossible.
Mm.
And what we are left with, if the limitations are adhered to, is a painting that kind of looks like a painting, surprisingly.
Mm.
Okay. There can be all kinds of limitations. I think that the better you are, the fewer limitations you can have. But you really have to earn that scope of tools to use. Mm. I really limit the amount of tools. So sometimes I limit the amount of colors on the palette. Sometimes I say, okay, use whatever number of colors that you want to use, but you only get to have seven shapes in that painting.
I love it.
Okay. So let's, when you are strictly limited to putting down seven shapes on a canvas, there is no chance you are going to paint those eyelashes.
Right.
Okay. So there's the theoretic approach and there's a practical approach, and they hopefully work together. Now this is something else. I remember the physicality. Yeah, the physicality. That can be treated as another limitation. For example, that the brush stroke must be visible.
Mm.
That's a very, very practical limitation, in my opinion. Some people really don't want that. They want the painting to be very pleasant and smooth. Okay? And I say, no, okay, we don't get to do that. every brush stroke must be visible. That really helps turn the painting into a process rather than into making a particular thing.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's brilliant. And I think that it speaks so immediately about painting as a language, which is something that you said, which I think is probably going to end up being the title of this episode, because language has limitations. You know, language, if you are using language well, then you don't have endless letters. You have a set of letters. You know, you have to do some things so such that people will understand what you're saying. You have to follow the rules of a language, and rules are sometimes just another way of saying limitations. So I think you're just on the money there, just creating those limitations will, I kind of ran through these exercises in my mind as you were explaining them, and it may sound simple to those of you listening, but these things will absolutely produce paintings as opposed to illustrations. So I think they're brilliant. Ilya, thank you so much for taking the time for doing this. This was amazing.
Ken, it was so fun and so pleasant. Thank you very much. It was a very meaningful conversation for me.
Thank you for joining me. If you enjoy this podcast and would like to see it grow, please take a moment to subscribe, rate it highly, and share it with a friend. If you'd like to become a supporter of the show and have access to exclusive content, please consider signing up as a patron at patreon.com/Ken Goshen. For online lessons, please visit kengoshen.com/lessons. Thanks again, and see you next time.